Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the program today, big banks and what their profits can tell us about the economy. Crude oil and what its price can tell us about the economy. And also, you and what you can tell us about the economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday is what my calendar says, the 14th of October. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. On Wall Street today, the focus was on Wall Street today. Repetitive, though that may have sounded, it is in fact what I meant. Three big banks, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, and JPMorgan Chase, reported profits this morning. They did more or less what analysts expected, some a little better, JPMorgan a little worse. There is always some economic tea leaf reading that bank profits call for. From our bureau in New York City, Stan Alcorn has it.
Wells Fargo, JPMorgan Chase, and Citigroup all posted profits today in the single-digit billions for the last quarter. Aaron Klein at the Bipartisan Policy Center says that's a positive indicator.
The return to profitability by banks of all sizes is a good thing for our economy.
Because more loans are being made and being repaid. But Klein says the more significant change is the loans themselves are higher quality. It's part of a sea change at the bank since the financial crisis. Fred Cannon is global head of research at KBW.
I would say they're far safer, better capitalized today than they were before the crisis, but they certainly aren't as profitable.
It's not just safer loans. Regulators have forced banks to spin off risky proprietary trading and to hold more capital or equity. That's a direct hit to one key measure of profitability, return on equity. Take Citigroup.
Before the crisis, because they didn't have much equity, the returns on equity were, you know, in the mid-20s. And today, Citigroup struggles to make it to 10%.
A less profitable Citigroup, but a safer financial system?
So that's the good news.
Dennis Kelleher is the president of Better Markets, which pushes tighter regulation for the financial industry.
The bad news is, if those circumstances repeat themselves, we're not in a dramatically different position than we were in 08.
The problem, Kelleher says, is that while the big banks may be less likely to fail, they're still too big to avoid having the taxpayers bail them out. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
Oil prices, as you may have sensed the last time you filled up your car, have been falling for the past couple of months. The through line thus far has been supply. There is so much oil out there, thanks in part to us, that prices kind of had to fall, right? Now, though, the other and honestly more troubling half of that equation is becoming clear. There are growing expectations that crude demand is slowing. The International Energy Agency says demand growth is at its lowest level in 5 years. 5 years ago, by the way, just in case you forgot, the global economy was in pretty rough shape. Marketplace's David Weinberg has that story.
The International Energy Agency expects demand for oil to grow by 700,000 barrels a day. That's 200,000 fewer than it previously expected. Antoine Half is chief oil analyst for the agency.
You know, I think the main driver really has been the economy. The economic recovery continues to disappoint, to be slower than expected.
The agency lowered its forecasts in large part because last week the International Monetary Fund lowered its forecast for GDP growth worldwide.
And now China, which for the last 10 to 15 years was the main engine of economic growth, has been slowing dramatically as well.
Slower growth in Asia and in developing nations around the world is a big factor in oil demand. Last year, for the first time, the demand for oil in developing countries exceeded that of developed nations. But growth in those developing countries is slowing, a worrying sign for oil producers, says IHS analyst Jamie Webster.
It's also a worrying sign for the economy and for oil markets because that is really considered to be the home for demand growth long term.
Despite the drop in global demand, so far at least, oil production has not decreased. As a result, analyst Stephen Kopitz expects gas prices to drop in the U.S., which could spur demand.
The caveat on that is that the miles per gallon for our automobiles has increased quite a bit.
Renewable energy sources don't make up a big enough share to cut into demand for oil. But gains in efficiency and the rise of the electric car, he says, could be game changers. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
From the global economy now to the economically local, we have been asking the past week or so for you to give us a call and tell us how your economy is doing right where you live. Today, the Rust Belt of Ohio.
My name is Michelle McBride Simonelli. I'm from Youngstown, Ohio. You know, the status of the economy in Youngstown has never been great. But that being said, I've lived in an area my whole life that's never really seen any economic boom. So when we're asked about the status of our economy and how it's been affected by the Great Recession, it's easy to say, well, how can you tell? My career right now has followed the trajectory of the Great Recession. I have done a little bit of work to kind of cobble together several part-time jobs in order to get back to the same earning capacity that I was working full-time just back in 2009. So I kind of call that the new American way. You can buy a house in Youngstown on eBay if you want for less than a car, but it's the quality of life issues that people are concerned about. The trick is, can you get those businesses to stay open? Because a lot of them are shuttering just as quickly as they open. Or can you get that tech center that you have growing in the middle of town and enable that kind of thinking and creativity to bring new young life to Youngstown and let it trickle down out into the community and the surrounding suburbs? So that's really kind of where we're at right now, treading water to see what happens.
Do us a favor, take a minute, just 1 minute, I promise. Let us know how your economy is doing. There's a spot on our homepage where you can do that. It's marketplace.org. On Wall Street today, fine, you know, whatever. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Consider now, if you would, the MOOC, Massive Open Online Courses, hence MOOCs, taught usually by college professors geared toward college kids or perhaps curious adults, or at least they used to be that way. As Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports from Learning Curve, which is our project about the intersection of education and technology, MOOCs are going to high school.
Dr. Janine Graham wrangles a room full of squirmy high school seniors. They're settling in for a psychology class at St. Margaret's Episcopal School in San Juan Capistrano, California.
Okay, so today, as promised, we're going to talk about this research study.
Today, she's teaching 18 kids about nature versus nurture. This February, she'll be teaching thousands.
I think it's incredible and also a little bit scary.
Graham is creating an intro to psychology MOOC for the online learning nonprofit edX, one of the biggest MOOC providers. Her class will be one of about two dozen free high school classes edX is launching over the next several months. Graham says for St. Margaret's, it's a chance to extend the school's mission of service and education. And personally, she says, her high school self would have jumped at the chance.
I grew up in a very small rural town. And I didn't have access to this kind of coursework, and I think I would have loved it.
It's those types of students the new edX offerings are after. Motivated, but without access. Many of the online courses are AP level in subjects like physics, environmental science, and chemistry. Anant Agarwal is the CEO of edX.
A lot of high schools do not have a rich set of AP courses. It's just too expensive.
MOOCs are free, though a student can buy a certificate of achievement. Agarwal says the number of middle and high schoolers taking edX's MOOCs could eventually account for about a third of the company's students. That's a pretty compelling market, considering edX has 3 million users now.
I think high schools will embrace this because learners can directly take some of these high school courses.
The question is whether they'll finish them. Currently, the MOOC completion rate is abysmal, only about 10%, which is part of the reason high schools have been slow to adopt them.
I see MOOCs as sort of a supplement, sort of an addition to, not a takeaway from, the educational experience.
Craig Wilson is the head of the University of Miami Global Academy, an online middle and high school that's experimented with creating its own MOOCs. He says most teens need teachers or mentors to connect with, to get them across the finish line.
What I see high schoolers really needing is still that sense of community.
Some high schools are experimenting with giving students credit for MOOCs taken as supervised independent studies. The digital education company Amplify is offering an AP-level MOOC with in-school coaches. Of course, some super-motivated, hyper-focused high schoolers aren't waiting on adults to figure MOOCs out. And a warning here. If you are a teenager freaking out about getting into college, or a parent freaking out about your teenager getting into college, you might want to turn the radio down for the next 30 seconds. James Lentner is a 17-year-old student in Georgia who takes MOOCs in his free time.
Let's see, I've taken five.
Behavioral Economics in Action, Energy 101, Medicinal Chemistry.
So I feel like if I'm learning something, that's better than just kind of rotting my mind playing video games.
Lentner says the classes have helped him figure out what he might want to study in college. And he's hoping they might also help him get in. He's including the MOOCs on his applications. That's right. Now you basically have to go to college before you can get into college.
So I just put something like MOOCs with edX, and then in parentheses what a MOOC is.
Just in case, he says, the admissions rep doesn't know. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
The World Health Organization was out with some distressing new numbers on Ebola today, as you might have heard. It said that by December, the number of new cases could hit 10,000 a month, and that the mortality rate in the three most affected countries is at 70%, 70%. That does kind of make the $25 million that Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg and his wife, Dr. Priscilla Chan, donated this morning seem almost a drop in the bucket. And in fact, it does point out the big difference in relief giving in this kind of crisis versus a natural disaster. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has that story from the health desk at WHYY.
You know what? Raising money for Ebola is hard. Jana Sweeney is with the American Red Cross.
We try to put up stories and information and photos and let people know. We have a microsite where there's a designated button that, you know, makes it easy for people to give.
But they don't. Or at least they aren't giving in significant numbers. The Red Cross, UNICEF, and Doctors Without Borders combined have raised $20 million for Ebola. Compare that to the $486 million the Red Cross alone raised after the earthquake in Haiti.
In the case of disease outbreak, I think that Americans immediately tend to think of government. Our government helps manage that.
The CDC Foundation, which is the philanthropic arm of the CDC created by Congress, is having more success than the traditional charities. It's raised $40 million.
What we've had to say to our donors is trust those 150 CDC experts who are putting their lives on the line.
That's Charlie Stokes, who heads up the CDC Foundation. Stokes says major givers like Mark Zuckerberg and his wife, Dr. Priscilla Chan, are trusting CDC epidemiologists to spend money at the scientists' discretion. That risk, plus the invisibility of a viral epidemic, makes raising money tricky.
We're talking about raising funding for people who are not yet sick, but may die 2 weeks from now. It's harder to put a face on those victims.
So Stokes puts a face on the public health scientists in the spooky hazmat suits in West Africa, and how they are the ones best positioned to control the virus. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up.
One of the misconceptions is that data will solve everything, as is one of the misconceptions that data is worthless.
BuzzFeed's take on the big data universe. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, those falling oil prices pretty much sucked the air out of the markets today. The Dow Industrial is off 5 points, less than a tenth percent, 16,315. The NASDAQ up 13 points. That's a third of 1%, 4227. The S&P 500 nudged itself up 3 points. That's about a tenth percent, 1877. Just to get back to banks, which we started with, Citigroup beat expectations, as you know, rang up 3% today. J.P. Morgan marched down nearly a third of 1%. Wells Fargo off 2.75%. Two companies related to Ebola that traded up yesterday gave back a lot of that ground today. Both hazmat suit maker Lakeland Industries and protective face mask company Alpha Protech dropped 26%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note to 2.20%. You're listening to Marketplace.
from the Marketplace Datebook. Here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The Federal Reserve releases its latest Beige Book summary of commentary on current economic conditions. Did consumers start off the fall season with new wardrobe must-haves? The Commerce Department reports on retail sales for September. And it's National Fossil Day, promoting awareness and stewardship of fossils. And it's educational. And dinosaurs, well, they're just not hanging around anymore. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There is, as we said up at the top of the broadcast, a whole lot of oil sloshing around out there, part of which is because the United States is producing so much of it. We are, according to the International Energy Agency, set to become the world's top producer. But with abundance often comes an unanticipated problem or two, because just as there is an oil boom, so too is there a boom in toxic oil field waste, waste that can end up in open pit disposal sites. From Texas Public Radio, David Martin Davies has that story.
It's a warm July Monday night in Nordheim, Texas, a town of 300, about 75 miles southeast of San Antonio. Farmers and ranchers are gathering at the old dance hall to organize against what they see as an environmental threat to their town. Jim Fulbright is a local rancher.
They're going to dump liquid oil field waste, all of the chemicals it has to do with fracking, and they have to do something with it.
Two enormous oil waste disposal facilities, one 200 acres and the other 575 acres, are being proposed for right outside of town. Retired school teacher Lynn Jansen is worried about her ranch, settled by her family in 1897.
There's just really no reason for our area to become the dump site for the Eagle Ford Shale.
Nordheim is in the middle of the most productive parts of the Eagle Ford Shale, a geologic formation saturated in oil. In 2013, it generated $87 billion in total economic output for the state of Texas.
I am not against fracking. I am not against the oil and gas industry. It's necessary. The country needs the energy.
The proposed waste facilities near Nordheim will handle millions of barrels of sludge. There are currently at least 67 large commercial surface facilities for oil field waste operating in Texas.
And if you've ever been around an oil rig or one of these waste dumps, there ain't no Chanel number 5 there. It all stinks.
It doesn't just stink. The EPA and others have found that the fumes contain chemicals known to be hazardous to human health, including volatile organic compounds like benzene. But because oil and gas waste is exempt from federal hazardous waste regulations, most states don't require the monitoring of air emissions. So it's impossible to know if the chemicals are drifting into the air at levels high enough to affect public health.
Now, I'm just going to kind of let this thing self-regulate.
Last month, about 30 residents of Nordheim chartered a bus and took the 150-mile trip to Austin to testify at a public hearing about the pits. Also at the hearing, Republican State Representative Jeannie Morrison. She said the state needs these facilities, but
I'm not naive that we will always be confronted with the not in my backyard position. But this is truly in the backyard of the entire city of Nordheim.
But as Nordheim had its say, so did the company that is proposing the pits, Pyote Reclamation Systems. John Soule is their attorney. He stressed one particular point 5 times in the first 2 minutes of his presentation.
The waste that will be received is RCRA, or Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, exempt oil and gas waste. By definition, non-hazardous.
Non-hazardous because of a decision made by Congress and the EPA back in 1988 to exempt oil and gas waste from federal regulations in a move to spur domestic oil production.
It's entirely a matter of politics.
Ernest Smith literally wrote the book, the textbook, on oil and gas law. He's a specialist in the area and teaches it at the University of Texas Law School.
The oil and gas companies had sufficient pull that they were able to get it classified as non-hazardous.
But Smith believes this exemption won't last forever. He says pressure is building on the federal government to fix it, but that would come at quite a cost to industry, at least a 6-fold increase in waste processing cost. That's why it's not likely to come in time to keep the pits out of Nordheim. In San Antonio, I'm David Martin Davies for Marketplace.
David's story was a partnership between Inside Energy, Inside Climate News, and the Center for Public Integrity. BuzzFeed, the site most widely known for its listicles and quizzes and lightning-fast growth, made a couple of promotion announcements today. The biggie was moving Dow Win up to publisher, a title that means something quite different than it used to, which makes sense because media is quite different than it used to be as well. Dow Win was no small part of what has been happening at BuzzFeed. She ran the team that came up with a data-driven strategy behind BuzzFeed's crazy growth the past year or so. They are now at 150 million visitors a month, which is, believe you me, a boatload. Dow Win, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Congratulations, first of all, on the new job. What exactly does it mean that you're going to be the publisher of BuzzFeed?
Well, the literal definition of publishing is to make information available to the public. And in a traditional media operation, that often means that the person is in charge of the printing press or distribution, right, deals with newsstands. Whereas for a purely digital operation like BuzzFeed, the publisher is in charge of the entire tech platform and all the tools to interface the content with the rest of the web.
You know, so I did an interview with Jim Bankoff. He's the CEO of Vox Media, as I'm sure you know. And I asked him basically how he looks at numbers, right? Because they have all kinds of analytics, as you guys do. And he said, we prefer to be data-informed rather than data-driven. Do you subscribe to that?
I do subscribe to that. I think that data should not dictate your strategy. You should not be slaves to the numbers, but you should use them in an optimal way. You should understand what data tells you and also understand what its limits are.
Yeah, because it can't tell you why. That's the thing. Can't tell you
That's
why
right.
things are happening. It tells you what's happening all the live long day, but it can't tell you why.
At best, it can tell you what is happening.
You know, and not necessarily that you guys have found the keys to the kingdom, but you are very good at getting your content shared, which is something that all of us in media are trying to do. What has been the most surprising discovery you've made along those lines?
One thing that is somewhat surprising when I discovered it is that women share at a much higher rate than men online. And when I talk about that now, sometimes I talk about it at a conference or with other people, I say women share more than men online as is in life.
Yes.
But men click at the same rate as women. So
all right, wait,
women
so,
will
so
share.
We click at the same rate, but women like to tell other people about it.
That's right.
Huh.
So women will start the conversation and men will participate.
What do you suppose that means?
If you think about it in the context of just regular human people, it isn't that surprising. And, you know, those are always the most fun.
Yeah. How much do you think about regular human people versus...
All the time.
Do you? No, because, I mean, you must spend your day deep in spreadsheets and databases and all that stuff.
Yes, yes. But we think about people all the time. I think that is a competitive advantage.
It has to be said, especially because you work in technology and you are in a position of influence now and have been, it has to be said that you're not a white guy, and that makes you a rarity.
Yes, that's true. Maybe you've seen recently that we have published our diversity numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that we do think about and we do talk about internally. It's not just an ethical imperative, but it's actually very important to our business to have a diverse newsroom. And I think for technology, it's the same.
As you start thinking about this next step in your professional life at BuzzFeed, where is this company going to go? Because you have a seat at the table now.
I think that BuzzFeed has a great opportunity to become the preeminent media company for the social age.
That's fairly grand.
Yes.
Dow Nguyen is the brand new publisher of BuzzFeed. Dow, thanks very much for your time.
Oh, you know what, Kai? I actually did one thing specially for you.
What did you do?
I sent an internal poll to everyone at BuzzFeed to see whether or not they say GIF or JIF.
No, did you really?
I did.
Oh, man. And?
And 86% of the company says GIF.
Okay, 86% of your company is wrong.
14% say JIF.
Yay.
And then, of the 86%, some untold percentage, probably in the single digits, claim that they used to say GIF, and then when they came to BuzzFeed, they were ashamed of the saying GIF.
Peer pressure, man. It's a terrible thing. Yeah, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today in which, yeah, well, I don't know. I guess it's just another step in the relentless march of commerce over common sense. From the Huffington Post today, this item: Macy's is going to start Black Friday, the big day after Thanksgiving kickoff of Christmas shopping season. And yes, I know it's not even Halloween yet. Do not get me started on that one. But anyway, Macy's is moving up the official start of Black Friday by 2 hours. It is now 6 p.m. Thanksgiving Day when those sales start, which stinks for oh so many reasons. What does not stink, though, is that we are going to be in New York on Thursday at the 92nd Street Y for a show we are doing live on stage called How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Numbers. Me, Delia Ephron, Misty Copeland, the ballerina, Hank Azaria from The Simpsons, and so much more. Yancey Strickler from Kickstarter, David Brancaccio, if you want to see what he looks like. Get your tickets, 92y.org. All right, we're done. Special Projects team is Nancy Fargali and Millie Jefferson. They are, by the way, on the way to New York. Lindsay Thomas and Caitlin Ash are on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Digital producers are Ariana Tobin, Shea Huffman, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. It's GIF, you guys. GIF. Pet peeve.